Thank you, Dov. Thank you, Katrin, for having me here. I'm like, it's really great to be here again. I've been here a couple of years ago, and that's when actually we've met for the first time. And the previous meeting was also around queer studies, so Hamburg has this kind of a special place on my personal maps and geographies, and it's this connection to queerness somehow. Before I go ahead with my today's talk, just a few words of introduction, how I kind of came to work around the topic, and a couple of technical things. So one thing, I do recognize that English is not our first native language, neither for me, neither for most of you, I suppose. So please wave your hand if I speak too quickly or you don't understand anything during the talk, and I'll try to clear it straight ahead. I've been living in London for 6 years now, and I moved to London from Warsaw, where I first started my involvement with sexuality when I became the volunteer for Lambda Warsaw, one of the lesbian and gay organizations. During that time of my activism, I became more interested in sexuality, not from on the activist point of view, but also more theoretically. That was the time when I when I began my studies, anthropology and cultural studies. So I fairly quickly went into sexuality studies. And then after finishing my studies, I've moved to London and began my PhD studies. And I found myself in this interesting queer, I'd say, in a way, and precarious position of being the Polish young man who came to London in 2004, that is the EU enlargement and the opening for the borders, and this massive wave of Polish immigrants that went to Poland. And since I didn't secure any scholarship, I had to pay for myself. As you may know, in England, higher education is paid. So in order to study, I had to pay and also had to live. I didn't have any scholarship. So I kind of started living this double life of Polish emigrant in London, doing what Polish emigrants can do at that very time, that is bar work, waiting, cleaning, all the kind of basic low-paid job that all kind of emigrants are supposed to do in the kind of machinery of immigration and low-paid jobs. And at the same time, I began my PhD studies, which are not only seen as advanced, but in British system, they also have kind of special aura, and they're seen as not seen as studying, but they seen as actually as professional research job, and the PhD students are treated as colleagues very often within the system. So on the one hand, I had this very low social position of Polish emigre in the bar work with the discussions, oh, how's it in Warsaw, or have you thought about doing any studies and perhaps doing something else after the bar work? And in the same time, I was in this kind of very high social position of doing research at the university and seen as a kind of elitist group, part of elitist group with any kind of social structure in Britain. So at times it felt fairly schizophrenic and precarious and queer. But this being kind of one leg in the situation, in those two words, in a way, made me think about my positionality within the university and with my studies, researching sexuality in Poland, thinking about doing it within the academic British system, which is very different to the German, which is very different to British and French, etc., which also has its impact on how we produce knowledge. And that said, actually the very system of how the university is organized is very, very important in the way what we produce and how we produce and how we start to think. And I was, in a way, pushed, and I had to go through the British academic system because that was my choice. But in the same time, I felt very uneasy with the certain mechanism of Western academia and its relation to what I was studying, my area studied, Poland. I had in mind my previous experience of studying in Poland and the access to knowledge, to English books, and the kind of looking up to West for the books when I was studying sexuality. And then suddenly I was in the situation when everything was there possible in the library. I'm like, situation that was terrific. For the first year, it was like I could just walk through the library and just looking at the books, because I've never seen in my life so many books about sexuality or gender. And all that, all those kind of personal experiences of being from various systems, from the Polish system to the British, and then living certain kind of double life in Britain, made me think and finally pushed me towards the research, which outcome I'm going to present a little bit here. So I told you all this kind of personal story because I think it is important to kind of see that this personal placement, and very much what I'm going to talk about is about this being placed or kind of localized somewhere. What I would like to see at the end of today's talk, I suppose, is also perhaps for you to kind of see yourself somehow placed in all what I've said and see what I'm talking, what I'm going to talk about, also through your own personal experience of studying, of being at university, and perhaps through your activism, that may be. Okay, so that's a kind of little intro. I will start with a short clip from Lost. I'm not sure if you've seen the Lost series. I want to show it not only because I do like Lost, but because the particular scene from the season, from the fifth season, is, I think, in a way, the kind of encapsulating in a perfect way what I'm going to talk about later on. Okay, so let's start.
The hell are you doing, Toby?
Checking to see if I'm disappearing.
What?
Back to the future, man. We came back in time to the island. We can change stuff. So if little Ben dies, he'll never grow up to be Big Ben, who's the one who made us come back here in the first place. Which means we can't be here, and therefore, dude, we don't exist.
You're an idiot.
Am I?
Yeah. It doesn't work like that. You can't change anything. Your maniac Iraqi buddy shot Linus. That is what always happened. It's just, we never experienced how it all turns out.
That was really confusing.
Yeah, well, get used to it.
I don't know why it's so synchronized.
The good news is that Linus didn't die. So that means the kid can't either. He'll be fine.
Didn't look like he was going to be fine. What if you're wrong?
Well, if I'm wrong, then I guess we all stop existing, and none of it matters anyway, then, does it?
Let me get this straight. All this already happened?
Yes.
So, this conversation we're having right now, we already had it?
Yes.
Then what am I going to say next?
I don't know.
Ha! Then your theory is wrong.
For the thousandth time, you dingbat. The conversation already happened, but not for you and me. For you and me, it's happening right now.
Okay, answer me this. If all this already happened to me, then why don't I remember any of it?
Because once Ben turned that wheel, time isn't a straight line for us anymore. Our experiences in the past and the future
occurred before these experiences right now.
Say that again?
Shoot. Please. Please.
Aha! I can't shoot you, because if you die in 1977, then you'll never come back to the island on the freighter 30 years from now. I can die, because I've already come to the island on the freighter. Any of us can die, because this is our present.
But he said Ben couldn't die because he still has to grow up and become the leader of the others.
Because this is his past.
But when we first captured Ben and Saeed, like, tortured him, then why wouldn't he remember getting shot by that same guy when he was a kid?
Huh. I hadn't thought of that.
Huh.
Ask me more questions about time travel.
Okay, I've got no idea why it was not synchronized, but actually, it is also quite the interesting experience that, again, kind of taps into what I'm going to talk about, the kind of sense of asynchrony. So, incidentally, perhaps not, here we are. So, Harley and Miles end their dialogue in confusion and uncertainty. The perplexity is caused not only because of the hero's current condition, that is, travel in time from 2007 to 1977, but also thanks to the usual way we conceptualize, theorize, and memorize time. For a short moment, we believe in Miles' explanation, construction of temporality. We seem to follow what he's saying. But then again, we get lost. Protagonists of Lost series find themselves not only lost in time, but also in space. The mysterious island on which they found themselves after the plane crash is a nowhere, no place, as we learn as the series develops. We learn that it is somewhere, but in fact, island's here placement is its temporal harboring. Time and space, in other words, are inseparable. Therefore, let me ask, if we live in queer times, where is Central Eastern Europe and where is West? How here of one of those myriad georeferents corresponds to and is translated onto here and there of the other? Is it possible to establish a relation between the West and Central and Eastern Europe as between the metropolis center and colony periphery, the kind of dichotomy that was somehow established in postcolonial studies? Not that far away.
Huh. I hadn't thought of that.
Huh.
Ask me more questions about time travel.
Mm-hmm. Here we are. Okay. So after the collapse of the Iron Curtain, Central and Eastern European countries quite unanimously adopted Western style of political and social engagement without much questioning of historical particularism and suitability for their context. When lesbian and gay activism began to emerge in Central Eastern European countries, West was already at the queer stage, right, in the 1990s. With long history and plurality of models, forms of engagement, goals and structures. Conversely, the communist past of Central Eastern Europe built completely different social structures and modalities. This could be geographically represented as two separate geopolitical temporal modalities, communism and capitalism, running parallel when in 1989 one of them finished, namely communism, and the other one became universal, right? The capitalism. This is what Francis Fukuyama once called the end of history, right? The neoliberal democracy and capitalism winning over the decades of long struggle for dominance in the world of ideologies and politics. However, for the West, the continuity was preserved, and the end of communism, 89, may be placed as just another event in the history. For Central Europe, this change was much more abrupt and sharp, literally bringing a collapse of one world and the promise of brave new world, perhaps. It all happened much more coincidentally than sequentially, everything at once. Indeed, it should be even more complicated and represented as constant knotting and looping of time, times after 89. So this Western times of sequence and Central Eastern European time of coincidence might therefore look as follows. It will go ahead again in a second. So here we've got this narrative from the West in terms of sexual politics. 1950s, homophile movement, then 70s, gay liberation, then AIDS, then queer, then antisocial turn, etc. That's the common narrative of development, right? And this parallel time of communism there. That's not perfect. I want to show it. Okay, so when in 1989 the communist time ended and the physical borders began to dismantle, the flow of exchange of materials and products and ideas really took over, as I said. So this, you see, I'm like something finished, 89, there's a small leak and done, and this nothing, kind of mixture of everything. Please bear in mind that it is a simplification, and I will return to it at the, later on in the talk and try to reflect on how we kind of see and present ourselves in our work, this kind of idea of periodization. So the perturbance of clutching ideas into which Central and Eastern Europe was thrown into was far from linear and progressively accumulative vision of time, which continued to unfold in the West. And we're working on sexual politics to give the example. So the strong assimilationist model of activism currently present in Central Europe could be read as stepping back in time into Western homophile times of 1950s and 60s. This pledge of we are the same, we are normal, please give us a little bit of space in the society. Right? Yet this going backwards is in fact stepping forwards, if only because for the first time there is any sort of activism and the people can self-organize to pursue their politics based on sexuality. So additionally, these homophile-like claims of acceptance and assimilation may be attempted by jumping into 1970s, the gay liberation time, and by using more kind of contestation strategies and pride parades are the kind of best example, right, of this implying of the 1970s. Strategies. At the same time, other groups label themselves queer and draw directly on, for example, queer nation events like key scenes in public spaces. Therefore, for LGBT activism in Central Europe, 1990s is truly a queer time. A time of mismatched models and realities, strategies and possibilities, understandings and uses, all at once. It is a time when real and fake, the original and the copy, collapse into the same, the one. And yet, nothing is the same and nothing is straight anymore. But had it ever been? And now let me just show you a couple of examples of those strategies I've said that exist simultaneously. It will go out. So the first one, you'll see it, that was campaigned, that one. Okay, runs. The first one, serious. On the right is Let Them See Us campaign, in 2003 organized. Series of 30 posters, 15 lesbian, 15 gay couples. As you see, the old pictures were like this. Just ordinary boys and girls standing holding hands. As normal as it can get. The whole campaign by the organizers was about normality. Every interview, every text written was about normality. And like every second word was normal, normal, normal. How normal we are, how normal grocery buyers we are, etc., etc. I'm like, it was obsessed with normality. And the reaction was outrageous. I'm like, the reaction in society, in media, all across, that spent for a couple of months of huge discussions across all sorts of channels, was if the pictures was of most outrageous, hardcore porn that we can imagine that would steer this stuff. In 2007, another campaign was organized by the same organization, by the way. You see two posters. At the beginning, they've presented the one on the left, which means, what are you staring at, lesbo, dyke? What are you staring at, queer? What are you staring at, faggot? And after a month or some time, another series of posters appeared saying, lesba, faggot, dyke. I hear it every day. It hurts. There was no reaction at all. Not at all. Completely not taken by media, by conservative side, by religious authorities, by nobody. Completely unacknowledged in a way. Although the second one had much more exposures. Because the first one was meant to be in the public spaces, yet because of all the outrage it evolved, all the major companies, the poster companies, private business that was paid, they stepped back and actually...
I was just wondering where this campaign took place, in
Poland? Yeah, in Poland. They Polish examples. So actually, all the first one was happening through the media, in the press, in telly, but not in the street. The other one was actually in the streets. I'm like, there were posters on the bus stops, in the billboards, etc., in major big cities. In Poland. Yet there's no reaction. So we have the first campaign, fairly assimilationist, very kind of about this normality and claim to be included into society. And the other one, which we could say to be more queer, about hate speech, more in your face, more kind of aggressive in approach, saying like, look at me, I'm like, it hurts, kind of trying to capture the spectator. And no reaction at all. So that kind of shows, I'm like, the kind of blur of the stuff. Therefore, we could say, for example, that the first campaign, although it can be read from the kind of Western narrative point of view as homophile, we could actually say it was queer in Polish context because of the reactions. And the other one, although it was kind of queer in terms of strategies, as it could be classified in the kind of Western American narration, was kind of assimilationist, and invisible, not queer at all, in a sense. Okay. And here are also kind of examples there was just more examples there. Okay. So, in all this, I'm like, when I was trying to describe and explain the kind of mismatch of periodization and strategies, what I've already presented is an attempt to untie the knot and linearize the present here and now reality of Central and Eastern Europe. And I've done it through categorizing various activities, attitudes, and approaches present all at once, at the same time, as belonging to certain historical sequential narrative, thus organizing the knotted temporality of Central and Eastern Europe into stages and inscribing it into particular familiar history. And I'm assuming that the history I've presented earlier of the homophile calibration, etc., is familiar. But my question is, do I actually succeed in trying to explain that the kind of mixed situation of Central Europe through this periodization and by constant reference to Western history of sexual activism? Does such unknotting make sense, and for whom? In other words, why certain models, notably Western and even more notably American, of LGBT activism and its history are familiar to all, and I assume that we are all familiar, and that's also another level of this kind of assumptions of familiarity. And why those models are perceived as the one and not one of many. Why each history that I'm trying to write and all other people working on other regions outside of the West, working on Asia or Africa, etc., constantly somehow refer to this one history, the one, the Western one, American one, and it is not treated as just one of many. So, in this narrative, another stage in development from Western perspective, not the time, because from Central and Eastern European perspective, it is just the beginning. And this constant disjunction and crossover and mismatch, we suggest, needs to become problematic for West and from its other, for Central and Eastern Europe. It is troublesome for Central and Eastern European people who are trying to catch up with the West, right? We need to have this legislation because all the West, all the EU is having it. We need to catch up with what's in the West. And although we are living in the same, in common present, the feeling is that we are actually somehow backwards. But it is also problematic for West, who see Central and Eastern Europe as lagging behind and dragging the progress down. And equally here, Central and Eastern Europe is seen as contemporary, yet somehow hindered and behind, that needs to be dragged to this modernity, right, of our Western now. So, discursively, it is forcing Western present as Central and Eastern European future to be achieved. Consequently, Central and Eastern European present is coerced as past. Although since 1989, the Central and Eastern European present and the Western present are the one of the capitalist liberal democracy. Right? So, paradoxically then, the Western progressive narrative unfolds into own aporia. And since that would annihilate the very idea of Western progress, something else needs to be done. Some mechanisms needs to be deployed to differentiate between the West and Central and Eastern Europe to be not at the same time. So although communist time collapsed into Western narration of capitalism, making it the one, the parallel is actually still kept at place. We suggest that, for example, constant referral to Central and Eastern Europe as post-communist countries or during transformation is one of those discursive strategies of kind of differentiating West and Central Europe. Because by constant referral to saying post-communist countries, it is always hindered that they are behind, somehow catching up, right? And the question is, who is to decide when the post-communism ends, when the transformation will end, right? It is not said, and we won't go into the agency discussions, etc., but we can easily, I'd suggest, assume that it is not up to Central and Eastern Europe to kind of say, here we are in modernity together with the West, right? I'm like, the kind of the power of discourse lies somewhere else. So what is at stake here is power and hegemonic strategies of subordination. Central and Eastern European is contemporary periphery. That's how we kind of want to describe it in this project with Joanna. Because it is contemporary periphery, because it is European enough geographically, but yet not enough advanced to become Western temporally. This temporal disjunction and the meaning of time, temporality, and history is shaped by economic and political conditions. And these, in turn, have clear gender and sexual underpinnings, as we all know. The hegemonic temporality of West is constructed as continuous and linear, progressive and accumulative, from old primitive to new advanced. As such, it becomes clear that the contemporary Western notion of time has underpinnings in classical liberal ideology of individual in a progressive, future-oriented world. And here, following Lee Edelman's queer polemic that sparked discussion about queer rejecting such liberal future-oriented temporal trajectory, the so-called antisocial turn. We would like to tap into this discussion and show that Edelman's claim that queer should reject the hetero and homonormative trajectory of progressive future-oriented world, symbolized by the figure of a child, does not hold in the context of Central and Eastern Europe. If only because the notion of the future in that region is very different to the notion of the future as developed in the West. And very much the criticism we could perform is the criticism that that appeared during the discussion in States from coming from people of color, from queer immigrants, from feminist critique showing that it is actually that the Edelman's proposition is a very privileged position to be able to fuck the future. And there are an array of positionalities and identity positions that simply cannot afford to fuck the future because they are already situated as somehow dead. Therefore, the future is the only hope to become alive, in a way. So, as a matter of a brief summary of what I've said so far, what we try to do is to ask if it is possible to do queer politics without a historical baggage. Is it possible to do non-identitarian politics, that is the Western model of queer, without first going through a stage of identity politics? As much as these are open questions without definite answers, what we want to suggest is that perhaps more important is the need to contextualize meanings and focus more on cultural translation of queer, conceptualizing it each and every time anew. And as I've shown you on the previous examples of those campaigns, so if we contextualize what it means to do queer politics, we may find out that the queer politics in Poland is a very different to queer politics in states, yet it is queer because the notion of queer needs to be deployed differently, and we just cannot simply take it and use it. So more attention to cultural translation. Okay, let me change the slide again. Mm-hmm. So I was talking a little bit about the time, and now a little bit more about the space and geography in the connection. So as I said, we're trying to work on sexual politics in Central and Eastern Europe, but we feel we need to do it, and it is necessary to do it in connection and relation to West. In this work, we found especially inspiring and interesting the post-colonial theories, problematizing the categories of center, metropolis, West, but also periphery and the otherness. In this work, we join the voices calling for wider coverage and scrutinization of not only the colony, not only the other, but also the scrutinization of the metropolis, of the center. And for example, by introducing Central and Eastern Europe, that is the post-communist countries, that is the former second world, we want to work on those categories of first, second, and the third world. So the no longer existing communist second world, remnants of which fall on the Central and Eastern Europe, is located somewhere between developed countries of first world, that is West, and developing countries of the third world. But this position after 89 also kind of disrupts this center-periphery first-third relations. Geographical, political, economic, and temporal status of Central and Eastern Europe makes it to be at times either in the first or the third world, at times in both simultaneously, and at times in none of them at all. Consequently, we need to ask, where exactly does Central and Eastern Europe locate itself? And where is West? Does geographical being in Europe automatically grant the privilege to be in the global north? Or because Central and Eastern Europe is catching up with the West, would this place it more as kind of in the category of the global south? Another set of categories that is recently deployed to talk about inequalities in the world politics. How global is the global, right? Especially in the light of the resurgence of nationalist movements after 89 and 9/11, as more and more scholars highlight, cultural attitudes and legal provisions for lesbian and gay people are becoming important factors of creating and maintaining modern divisions of us, that is West, civilized, secular, pro-gay, and them, Orient, primitive, religious, and anti-gay. So we joined this discussion and show another dimension how this process works, not only in relation of West-Orient, but also West, Central, and Eastern Europe. And in a way, we also would like to suggest that the relation between the West and Central Europe is perhaps a little bit more complicated than the relation between the West and the Orient, the Islam, because it is not as easily classifiable along this us and them lines, as I've tried to show. So, what is Central and Eastern Europe? There are many labels in use denoting, describing, and indicating what Central and Eastern Europe might be. There are geographical ones: East, Central Europe, Eastern Europe, Balkans, Southern and Eastern Europe, or just Southern Europe. There are historical ones: post-communist, former communist, former Soviet, former Soviet satellite countries, former communist bloc, countries behind the former Iron Curtain, etc. There are also political ones: post-authoritarian, emerging democracies, new democracies, transitioning countries, developing democracies, or consolidating democracies. There is also a set of terms relating to EU only, new members, second wave enlargement, aspiring countries. And of course, the use of these names is neither systematic nor consequent, and they all being used as parallel and synonymous somehow. And the three types under which I've grouped them are only to highlight how geography, history, politics, and time are the fabric of which these categories are made of. And since the labels are highly contended and conflated, the intention, meaning, and understanding relies heavily on the user rather than on the label itself. So let me give you two brief examples. The first one is about Poland. Is Poland central, or is Poland an Eastern European country? In the UK, anyone asks, yes, Poland is Eastern European country because Eastern Europe begins with eastern border of Germany. Anything east is Eastern Europe. If you ask anyone in Poland, the answer is no. Like, no, no. Poland is European or eventually Central European. East is east of Polish border. Right? What does it mean? I'm like, except of the very obvious statement that it all is relational and depends on the point of view, I'm like, there is something else there as well. Another example, Germany, which I want to bring, and the former division. What about the Eastern Germany and its past as a communist country? I'm like, is Germany Eastern European, Central Eastern European country? In England, not at all. Germany is West. In Poland, Germany is West. In Germany, I'm looking forward to hear your opinion, how the former division is played out in everyday life. But I have impression, yet again, that the past, that the history, that the communist past of Eastern Germany was erased in a significant way. And although the Eastern Germany, as we all know, faces exactly the same problems as all other communist countries, slow economy, unemployment, migration towards the West, from the rural to urban, etc., etc., and you're all very aware how much money was pumped into Eastern by the government from the West into Eastern Germany, and also tensions, which I'm sure you are much more aware politically between the money and the development in discussions of the culture, how it developed. It is there, and yet still the past is erased. I'm like the communist past of Germany. And yet again, there is something there in how we think about Central and Eastern Europe that blurs and needs our attention. Another question, what is West? And the answer, again, is not so simple. So West is a myriad constellation floating in a time space of own perceptions and Eastern European idealizations. So it is at times synonymous to Europe, sometimes more precisely to European Union, and sometimes to Western Europe. It denotes Europe and America, or just America. And in America, we'd rather think United States than Canada. Yet at times it appears there as well. West is Anglo-America, or West is liberalism and progress. West was, for Central and Eastern Europe, a promise of freedom, a kind of El Dorado, a dreamland of colorful prosperity here and there. West was, is where we, Central and Eastern Europe, want to be. Finally, West is normative ideal of how things should be. That's the model. All other countries need to develop up to this model. So how to make sense out of what is actually meant each time West as a category is invoked, I don't know. As much as I want to rationalize and categorically understand and understand through existing categories, we also feel, and it is precisely the feeling, something that escapes the word and kind of rational denotation. So it is the feeling that none of the above explanatory terms fills the vessel of West completely. We feel that even the most precise denotation of West, like European Union, always carries a baggage or just a small handbag or just a pocket full of other labels, always echoing something else in a never-ending chain of equivalences and relationality. So what does it mean in the context of queer studies, knowledge production, and LGBT activism? Possibly that for us, for me, for Joanna, and for many other scholars somehow rooted in Central and Eastern Europe, Western means English. Anglo-American, in fact, it should be even narrowed down to say just American. We've presented with Joanna this talk or the ideas that I'm presenting now at certain other events, and it became striking for us that our own idea of what was West and way we were conceptualizing the West as Anglo-American or thus as West was actually just American. And coming back to this previous schema of the periodization, we called it Western time of sequence, the 50s, 60s, 70s, etc. But it is indeed just an American model of sexual activism. British scholars and historians of sexuality would not agree with such categorization. I'm sure the history of sexual politics in France and Germany are also at least different than the American model. So we also want to acknowledge here that in our own work, we somehow, although we are criticizing the relations between the West and the other, between the West and Central and Eastern Europe, we somehow necessarily operate within the categories and somehow also reenact them, although we seek to criticize those relations. Even more, it's not only about our simplification of idea of what West is, it's also certain simplification of what Central and Eastern Europe is. When we talk about 89 and give this 89 as a kind of point of reference, the symbolic one that everything changed, well, it holds true in Poland, where sexual activism began just months after. But for example, in the Baltic states, the first kind of organizations and sort of sexual activism appeared around 2005 only. In Bulgaria, the first public action pride was organized in 2010, whereas in Slovenia, lesbian and gay organizations existed throughout the 80s, already under the communism. So we need to also yet again think that the Central and Eastern Europe is a set of countries with their own particular individual histories. So it's not only about simplifying West, but it also in our own work also we kind of become more and more aware that we are also simplifying the idea of the East. Therefore, we also need to give a credit to feminist situated epistemology literature that call for the self-reflexivity. And here also the kind of point of connection to what I've said at the beginning of my talk, of my own personal narration, how I came into the story, and for all of us, perhaps, how we kind of come into our interest and where we are intellectually. So, keeping all this in mind, what is the possible lesson one can draw from exercises I've just done about the West and Eastern Europe? Perhaps the conclusion is that since none of the markers can be perceived as stable, the West and Central and Eastern Europe are ultimately phantasmagorical here and now, two regions impossible to be enclosed within fixed boundaries, neither geographical nor temporal, historical nor political. West and Central Europe are thus relational concepts. And as such, they entail hierarchies of power, subversion, resistance, and hope. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's okay. Sorry. Yeah, that's fine. It works. So that's a little bit. That's just another example. Example which I really like, that shows this mismatch and the temporal disjunction all at once. Replika is a free bimonthly magazine, lesbian and gay magazine, and it states 20 years, meaning 20 years has passed, time for change. And what we see this gay cowboy icon, popular kind of iconic figure within gay community in the West. Yet behind it, and it says równość, that is equality, it behind there is a poster, solidarność, solidarity poster with John Wayne from High Noon marching. A famous and iconic poster in Polish history from the first strikes, the poster that was used, that kind of became the kind of symbol of the change and the collapse of communism, with the names of Lech Wałęsa, Mazowiecki, etc. So we have already there the kind of mix of the West and East. We have the John Wayne from Western movies, right, marching to kind of destroy the communist past with the kind of army of solidarity. And then we have this gay retake on it, about the equality. And in a way, it is a pure example of what queer may be, in a way, for me. I'm like, it has it all on so many different levels. It speaks to national history, it speaks to the relation between the West and the East, etc., etc. And so, as a conclusion, what I would like to repeat once again at the end is that what I would like to repeat. Okay, so the one thing that I want to highlight is that we are offering the contemporary periphery kind of concept and concept of temporal disjunction and time of sequence versus time of coincidence as a perhaps useful way of thinking about Central and Eastern Europe, European enough, but not yet Western. Therefore, we take the geotemporal rather than only geopolitical approach, which we believe offers perhaps wider spectrum of possibilities of understanding current processes of transmission of sexual identities and models of activism. And just to finish it, I want to show you a little clip that has it all in a way. There we are. Thank you.